This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
So that's one thing in my life I do regret, that I don't know my own native tongue. My children know their native tongue.
We were in many instances the first white folk that had come down the road.
All around us, incredible wind, destruction, just things flying through the air and everything.
Well, this wrenching, pulling back and forth.
And my children will know what happened on Bloody Sunday. They won't read it from a history book. They won't read it from anything that has distorted it, made it up the way they think it was.
But it was dead calm where we were.
Or you wish you hadn't have gone down that road. There's a lot of roads we go down that we wish we hadn't have gone.
And it just seemed miraculous that within 3 days you could go from that world to this world.
My children will know Bloody Sunday, the history of it from me, because I was there.
Greetings from Sebastopol, California. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller with stories about journeys. Quick hellos today, because we've got a pretty full plate.
On January 30th, 1972, in Derry, Northern Ireland, British paratroopers opened fire on a huge demonstration against British policy of internment without trial.
A policy that's now part of life in the United States.
13 people were killed. The army claimed it had come under fire and was cleared by a tribunal who ignored numerous eyewitness reports. The day was called Bloody Sunday, and its memory remains vivid.
We spoke with an Ulster woman who was there. We met her in San Francisco, where she was acting in a play on tour from the Derry Playhouse. But when she was 20, she wasn't an actress or an activist. She was just a hairdresser who was crazy about the Beatles.
This is a story about a trip downtown to do some shopping. Carmel McCafferty lives in Derry, Northern Ireland. She's 54, 3 kids. One day in August 1969, her mother needed some groceries, so she walked down to Waterloo Square, and her life changed.
And because there was a 12th of August parade, we weren't allowed in. And I couldn't understand this, why I wasn't allowed into my own square to shop. And the parade came round, and there was one woman in the parade who was called Orange Lil. And she lifted her dress and showed us her knickers, which were Union Jacks. And that just seemed to spark something in my head, that this woman from Belfast could walk my streets and I couldn't. So a riot started. I picked up my first stone that day. I wanted to hit that woman. I wanted to hit her in the face too. I wanted to see her blood. I really did, because, you know, what right had this horrible woman? She was a horrible woman. Got to stop me walking around that corner to do my grocery shopping. I wasn't stopping her marching. I resented her marching, but I certainly wasn't stopping her. She was stopping me. She stopped the whole bloody William Street. They threw up a barrier, won't let us in. So yeah, I remember picking up that stone, throwing it. Wish I had kept it now, been valuable. And I rioted my way through the end of the 60s, all of the 70s. And I tried in every way to make the British government and the unionist government see that I was as entitled to my rights as they were to theirs. We fought in our own streets. We were beat off our own streets. I rioted every day of my life. I just wanted what was rightfully mine, and I didn't know any other way of getting it. Housing in Derry was very, very bad. So my sister Nell, Eamon McCann, Bridget Bond, Kathy Harkin, and a few of us decided we would start protesting for new houses. We trailed caravans across the Lecky Road. We blocked traffic. We sat down in the street. We generally protested for everything that we wanted. During that time, the rioting escalated and the British Army was brought in.
The media call it Protestant Catholic violence. But the issue for her wasn't religion. She had Protestant and Catholic brothers and sisters. The issue was the future.
My mother encouraged us to fight. She herself came to Roswell Street. She would have said, you know, be careful. Usual things mammies say, be careful, don't get caught. Take a wet cloth with you and wash your hands on the way home, because that was the first thing the British Army did, was check your hands if they were dirty. And we fought continuously on the streets of Derry. We barricaded ourselves in until one day this, I can't remember the date, this, we wakened up one morning to a ring of steel around our city, and it was a ring of steel. We couldn't get out and nobody could get in. And they lifted our men. They took them from their houses. They took them from work. They took them from walking along the streets. They took them from coming out of mass. And they interned them without trial. We hadn't a clue what was happening, because nobody knew where they were taken. Nobody knew what they were doing to them. So we had to go to the streets again. And this time the British Army decided to use tear gas and rubber bullets. Rubber bullets were very new to us. We didn't know what they were. We thought they were these great things, you know. Well, we were catching them, taking them home, making them into ornaments. But there was lots of people blinded, paralysed, killed by these rubber bullets. And eventually, we learned that internment was brought into Derry in Belfast, and our men were put into prison. We didn't see them for 72 hours. And then when we did see them, they were so traumatised, because they had been, although the British Army have never admitted it, they had been tortured. There was white noise, which went on all the time in their cells. The lights didn't go out. They were blindfolded, taken up in a helicopter and thrown out, even though it hadn't left the ground. But if you're blindfolded, you don't know that. And these men stayed in prison. So the woman had to take up the role of being the aggressor. And then the dirty protest started, and the hunger strikes. The dirty protest was where the men and the woman decided they wouldn't wash, they wouldn't do anything. All they wanted was a right to wear their own clothes, a right to have visitors, human rights, nothing that any other prisoner in the world wasn't granted. And the dirty protest was one of the most frightening times in our campaign, because, well, you know, natural things happen to your body, and they never left the cells. They smeared the walls with excrement. They didn't wash, they didn't shave, and they slept on a blanket, one blanket. It was called the blanket protest. And then the hunger strike started. And we really thought Margaret Thatcher wouldn't let any of our fellas die, but she did. And they died horrible, horrible deaths. The hunger strike lasted 30-something days, I think. Can't remember now. Bobby Sands died. Two fellas from Derry, Devine and I can't remember his name, died. But I remember Mickey Devine's sister saying, what will stay in her mind forever and ever is not the fact that her brother died, but the smell of him as he died. She had his breath, his teeth, his body. It was just breaking down in front of her. And she says, that will stay with her forever. When Bobby Sands died, an awful stillness came over the north of Ireland. We normally rattled bin lids when something happened. We not only banged them on the ground, we scraped them along. And you know metal on concrete, it's a horrible sound. So we called them our screaming bin lids. And our bin lids screamed loud. It started with one the night Bobby Sands died. And then everybody took up their bin lid and trailed it along the ground screaming. So the sound was, it was horrendous.
What's missing from the newscasts isn't that a riot starts, but that it starts when you're shopping for groceries and that people still live their lives.
I got married during this. My husband and I were both known as nationalists. So our house was raided many an occasion. And the morning they left at Kevin was our wedding anniversary. And the family doctor, my family doctor, his practice was very close to our home. So when they left at Kevin and took all the papers that they thought were IRA papers out of the house and stuff like this, they left, and I took a very bad headache. So when the surgery opened, I went round and told Dr. Fallon about the headache and about different things. Kevin was left it, and he got on the phone, and he phoned the police, and he phoned a lawyer, a solicitor, and he phoned other people. And then he said, are you all right? And I says, I have a really bad headache, and I feel quite sick. And he asked me would I go into his bathroom and give him a sample of my urine? And I came out of the toilet and gave him the urine, and he went away to his wee laboratory, and he came back. He said, you don't have a headache, girl, you're pregnant. So my husband was left it the morning I found out I was pregnant, and I didn't see him for 3 days, so I told nobody. And I was told before this that I was never going to have children because I only had one fallopian tube and it was deformed. So eventually when I got on to see Kevin, I asked him how he was doing, and he said he was grand, and he was sorry about all this, and I was saying, don't apologise, Kevin, what's what we fought for, you know, it could happen to me tomorrow. And I said, how's my mammy? And I says, your mammy's great, and all the usual chat-chat, and I said, I'm pregnant. And he went on chatting, and how was school? And I said, school's great, Kevin, and everybody's great, and I haven't gone into work now for 3 days, and I'm pregnant. And he said, sure, a bastard's on here, you know, Carmel. They say awful things to you about you not being... What did you say there now? I said, I'm pregnant. I said, get out of this hellhole. Get you and my child out of this hellhole. Don't have my children in jail. Get them out. So that's how Kevin found out he was going to be a daddy. The trial fell apart, but he was on probation for 3 years. And he had to go to the barracks every Tuesday night to sign his probation form. I'm through my first pregnancy, Carrie and Mura, taking her to jail, you know. She thought her daddy was going to sign for a television licence. We never ever told her what it was for. In fact, it's only in the last, Mura's 19 now, and it's only in the last year we've told Mura all that has happened to her daddy and me. And I don't know if it was the right thing or the wrong thing to tell her, because her eyes lit up to such an extent I thought, oh, Jesus, now she's going to turn. She's going to start fighting. She's going to start, you know, because it's on our children.
And she remembers Bloody Sunday.
The Saturday previous to the Bloody Sunday march, there was a march in McGilligan Strand. The paratroopers were brought in then. That was the first time we'd ever seen a paratrooper. We knew then something was going to happen. We didn't know when, because Bloody Sunday was massive. You know, the day that we picked couldn't have been better. It was bright, sunny, warm, dry. I had a baked potato in my pocket because it was, you know, one of those cold, wintry days, but it was very bright. And I remember leaving the table to go on the march, and my mammy saying, take that potato with you, it'll keep your hands warm. I threw that potato at a soldier, you know. But the thousands of people that turned up that day from every nationality going. And before the march started, the atmosphere was bright and happy and gay. And, you know, we were just singing and dancing. When I think back on the things that we did that day, it was such a day. You know, we thought nobody. There are so many people here. It's international today. It's not just us. It's international. We thought we would have got everything we were going to ask for that day. We really did. End the internment, better housing, better schools, freedom of speech, that we could rule our own lives, that we would be allowed Andy Stormont as a government. But it didn't happen. I was with two boys who were shot. One was James Ray and the other was Michael McDade. James had this great notion, he was very Andy Gandhi, and thought, if we sat in the streets, because John Hume told us if we sat down, it was a peaceful protest and nobody would hurt us. So James and I sat on William Street and were hosed, battened, kicked, thumped. This was before the Paras came over that barricade. And when the Paras came over that barricade, we ran. We got separated. I ran up William Street, up Roswell Street, and I met Michael McDade, who was going on a date with his girlfriend in Buncrana. He couldn't get past the barricade because of the gas. So I took a scarf from my neck and tied it around his mouth. Michael never even made it to the end of Roswell Street because they shot him in the back, lifted him and threw him into a Land Rover. His family and myself to this day still think Michael could have been saved because he threw that many people on top of him, he suffocated. We left Feedery Corner and this awful stillness came over Derry. It really was. There was no sound. People's feet made no sound. No one spoke to one another. But yet with all, we walked home in hundreds, in groups, you know, just looking, nodding. Nobody spoke, except for the people who come up and say, there's one dead, and we went, oh, Jesus. And then, you know, there's five dead. And then all of a sudden, there was 11 dead. And the heaviness just got worse and worse. And we went home, and in my home in the Bogside, my sister's a journalist, Nell. The journalists collected in our home. And even they couldn't speak. They were stunned. And the news came on the television, and it was the IRA had opened fire on the British Army. There was no IRA there that day. The IRA were protecting Craigan on that day because the British Army were down, the people, the marchers, the thousands of us were downtown in the city centre. So Craigan was left open. I changed after Bloody Sunday a great deal. I wanted more than what I was marching for before. I wanted the Brits out. I wanted them out of my country, out of my life, off the world if it could happen. I just wanted them. I hated the accent. I hated their flag. Something happened to me. I really and truly knew then I learned how to hate on Bloody Sunday.
The peace process has begun, and for the time being, she's no longer a rioter. But I wondered, did she ever think, enough is enough? This is no place to raise my children. Let's just get out.
No. Never. I want them to know their roots. I want them to know what Ireland is like. I want them to know that they are going to be living in a free Ireland, that they're not going to go away and sit in some cosy corner of the world, and when Ireland's free, come back and say, I'm Irish. If they want to be Irish, and they have to work at it, they have to be there and struggle. Not as hard, I hope, as what I had to struggle or my parents had to struggle, but they have to stay and hold their patch. When I look at my Mura, Brendan and Cormac, I don't ever want them to throw a stone, fire a gun, throw a petrol bomb. I want them to be happy, happy, contented children. I want them to love their neighbour, respect themselves, respect each other, respect whoever lives next door to them. In Ireland, Catholic and Protestant are still edgy with one another. I have never loved freely, either in what we call Era or Derry, because I can't really walk into Era and embrace an Irish sister when I haven't really embraced my Protestant sister, who only lives up the street from me. And I have to embrace her before I embrace anybody, to let her know that it is over. We not only have to, but can love as human beings on this planet, wherever. That the marching, the protesting, all has to stop. I'm still active, and I'm 54 now, so it hasn't stopped for me. I'm not, we don't riot, we don't march anymore. We don't march anymore. We really don't march anymore. It's dialogue now. The dialogue doesn't always suit us, but it's getting us what we want. So I hope the end of my journey, from that day I went shopping on William Street, is that my children can go to any university in this world and I won't have to worry about what's going to happen to them. I'll worry as a natural mother that they're all right, they're eating well, washing themselves, cleaning their teeth, all those sort of things. But I don't want them to be in any situation where violence is going to strike them. Because it does change you. It takes away all that innocence and puts back something that's not pleasant. And no matter how soft we talk, or matter how pleasant we are to one another, there's always that wee thing at the back of your heart. Always that piece of hate that won't go away. I can't love the British Army. I can't love the British people. I just can't. But I really do want a better life for my children. I want them to be happy. I want Brenton to be as laid back and as musical as he wants to be. I want Cormac, who's a very intelligent young man. I want him to be a professional wrestler if that's what he wants to be. Muir is studying law in Trinity, which I'm very proud of. A law in the south from the north. God, I think she's wonderful. I really do. I want my husband and me to retire very soon. Live in Donegal. Visit Derry as often as I like. And embrace my brothers and sisters. That'll be the end of my journey.
In San Francisco, by way of Derry, we were talking with Carmel McCafferty.
A few weeks ago, our friend Kim Tripsmith described a harrowing trip to Morocco, and it was a great story, but we don't want to put a damper on the Moroccan tourist industry. Those people have to eat, after all. And so partly just to say Morocco's okay, and partly in keeping with Carmel's intense longing for oneness and peace in her own country, we'd like to include here a bit of Kim's interview. We pick her up in the midst of, well, let's just say, a pretty awful day.
We walk out, you know, and we get in the middle of the Medina, and lo and behold, he loses me. He loses me out in the middle of the Medina, and the Medinas are rough. I mean, it's not a place for a white woman really to go cruising around alone in the first place. And you get all these little kids coming up to you. Hey, you American? What are you? You know, and they know six languages. They're 6 years old, they know six languages, and they wait until they see that flicker of light in your eyes, and then they badger you to death. You need to go on holiday? I show you. You need guide? So I finally grabbed one of these kids and said, yes, I need a guide. Take me to the baths. So this kid takes me to the baths. I pay him off. And the baths were amazing. You go in and you buy and you rent two buckets. And it's kind of like, a school gymnasium in that there are two rooms that are walled up like halfway so that they're filled with water. And one is hot water and one is cold water. And so you fill one with hot water and you fill one with cold water. And then you go and find yourself a spot on the floor and you wash yourself. And when you're done, you get up and you get more water. Well, you know, I'm there with my soap and my scrubby and my conditioner and my shampoo and my apricot scrub for my face and, you know, all my little stuff that I carry around with me to make myself beautiful. And I look around and nobody in the entire place has anything. They're scrubbing their bodies with rags because this is probably the first time they've bathed all year. And they're looking at me like I am. I mean, it was the first time I'd very, very much been in a completely reverse racism situation where I was not the dominant culture at all. And people kept kind of coming over and touching me and checking me out and pulling on my hair. And at first I was intimidated and I thought, you know, oh my God, what have I done? I put myself in a weird situation again. Yet I'm clean, so who cares, you know? And then I thought, you know, this is an opportunity for me to show that, you know, once again, that all human beings can be good human beings, and I'm a good human being. So I started handing out the soap, and I used my entire bottle of shampoo, giving every woman some shampoo. And so all of a sudden, for the first time in their lives, we're all having a bubble bath in the middle of these baths, and women are touching each other, and they're using the soap in each other's hair, and they're coming over, and they're cleaning my hair, and then I show them what conditioner is, and we're all combing each other's hair, and they've never had conditioner, they've never really had combs. You know, my soap goes out, and I gave everything out, and it was wonderful, in the middle of all of the hell that I had been through in the last 48 hours, there was this blessing, defining moment. It was the ultimate high to feel the acceptance and the warmth and the camaraderie of these women, to be totally surrounded by women who I know were completely oppressed in their everyday lives, and suddenly, they had been given this special experience. And so there we are, with soap all over the place, and everybody's laughing, and everyone's having a good time. And so then when we were done, they gave me this beautiful white scarf, and they took my hair, and they braided my hair, and then they wrapped me in a real turban and did my face so that I was covered with a thing over my face, and so that I wouldn't be so hassled when I left. So, I mean, and I couldn't believe that somehow from out of nowhere had materialized this huge scarf that, you know, would serve to cover me, to veil me from the world. So I walked back feeling very empowered and very alive. And
We were talking with Kim Tripp-Smith. And that's our trips for this week. Hitchhiking Off the Map is a production of The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the contributing members of the Hitchhikers Guild. Visit our website, www.independenteye.org.
Next up, an Iraqi immigrant directs traffic between the 32 languages of Detroit.
And your memorable trip down the hallway to the principal's office.
We'd like to mention, for those of you who heard our recent Nativity series, that it is now on a single CD, all three programs. And you can get information on our website, again, www.independenteye.org, or you can call us at 800-357-6016.
Nativity is 26 women and a fair number of gods giving birth and hoping that in the midst of terror and oppression and war and the throwing of rocks and the bombing of cities and the nightmares coming alive, here's hoping that some little kid can lead us to the baths, and there we will joyously and delightedly scrub one another clean. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
I was very confused. Very, very confused. So I went home, and having me tea that night, I remember my daddy saying, they're not a peacekeeping force, they're a conquering force. And we're part, as they would like to think, of their empire. We're not. We're Irish. You're a nationalist. Go and do what I should have done 40 years ago for you. Fight for the rights of your children. Get them a better world and a better place, better education, better housing. So I finished my tea and went back to the street to riot.